content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service.
And this is the June 2023 edition of Education Today. The first article comes from U.S. News, and it's titled, Oklahoma OK's First Religious Charter School, Teeing Up Legal War Over Separation of Church and State. Board members approved the application for the country's first religious charter school, despite warnings from their own council that they would likely be sued. By Lauren Camera, posted June 6, 2023. Oklahoma officials approved what could become the country's first religious charter school, breaking new ground in the conservative push to expand school choice options while also teeing up what's expected to become a protracted legal battle over the separation of church and state. The Oklahoma Statewide Virtual Charter School Board voted 3-2 on Monday to establish St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School, an online school that would seem to flout the state's laws and its constitution by sending public dollars to a religiously affiliated school. The board members, including one who refused to recuse himself after being asked to do so because he was sworn in last Friday, approved the application despite warnings from their own council that they would likely be sued. The approval of any publicly funded religious school is contrary to Oklahoma law and not in the best interest of taxpayers, Oklahoma Attorney General Gentner Drummond said in a statement. It's extremely disappointing that board members violated their oath in order to fund religious schools with our tax dollars. In doing so, these members have exposed themselves and the state to potential legal action that could be costly. Members of the board are appointed by Republican Governor Kevin Stitt, who supports religious charter schools, and the state's GOP-controlled legislature. The move is part of a larger effort underway in red states to expand publicly funded voucher programs, tax credit scholarships, and education savings accounts that provide tuition assistance for children to enroll in private schools, including religious private schools. This is a win for religious liberty and education freedom, said Stitt, who just last month signed a new K-12 law that established a $150 million tax credit scholarship that families can use for private school or homeschooling. Charter schools, which were originally established to test innovative ways to teach and learn, are publicly funded schools run by independent boards. Roughly 8% of public school students are enrolled in charters, according to the latest federal data, and even fewer, 1%, are enrolled in virtual charter schools, which are notorious for being poor performing. Proponents of establishing religious charter schools argue that the process isn't different than state-run private school voucher programs that allow families to use taxpayer dollars to cover tuition at private schools, including religious schools. But critics point out that charter schools are not funded by families receiving an individual subsidy. They're funded by the state as public schools. The Archdiocese of Oklahoma City is trying to make charter schools into something they are not, Nina Rees, president and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, said in a statement. We stand ready to support charter school advocates on the ground in Oklahoma as they fight to preserve the public nature of these unique schools and protect the religious and civil rights of the students and teachers who choose them. Under Oklahoma's charter school law, a charter school must be non-sectarian in its programs, policies, employment practices, and all other operations, and also cannot be affiliated with a non-public sectarian school or religious institution. The Oklahoma Constitution also requires the state's system of public schools to be free from sectarian control. But the school's charter application specifically states that it will operate the school as a Catholic school. In addition, the law requires all charter schools comply with federal regulations and state and local rules relating to health, safety, and civil rights, meaning that a charter school cannot discriminate against students or staff based on religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, pregnancy, and disability by, for example, barring their admission or employment or expelling or firing them. Yet, the Catholic Virtual School's application indicated that it would comply with anti-discrimination federal laws and statutes only, quote, to the extent the teachings of the Catholic Church allow, and that it would only comply with all local, state, and federal laws and regulations governing fair employment practices, quote, that are not consistent with the faith or moral teaching of the Catholic Church. If those rules do run afoul of teachings of the Catholic Church, the application states that the school would claim a religious exemption. We must be very clear. This decision harms all public schools and students, says Robert Kim, executive director of Education Law Center, a nonprofit legal and advocacy organization. Charter school laws were passed based on assurances that they are public schools open to all students, he says. Allowing a religious charter school upends the very notion of public education by endorsing a school that has signaled it does not consider itself fully bound by state or federal laws, including non-discrimination requirements that are essential to a public education system. The moment has been years in the making, with conservative groups eager to apply recent Supreme Court decisions about public funding of religious private schools to the charter sector in cases decided as recently as 2017, 2020, and 2022. The justices ruled that religious schools cannot be barred from state programs that allowed parents to send their children to private schools using taxpayer-funded scholarships, education savings accounts, or voucher programs. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, New Type of Public Schools Specialize in Teaching Students with Dyslexia, by Elizabeth Hubick, posted June 12, 2023. By all accounts, 11-year-old Nathan Adler seemed to be set up for early academic success. His father is a teacher, his mother a speech-language pathologist. They've read to their son since he was very young. The local public school he attended screened for dyslexia risk factors 3 times per academic year, beginning in kindergarten. And that's when the results of Nathan's assessments began coming back in the red zone, indicating risk factors for dyslexia, a learning disorder that affects one's ability to read. Nobody from his school ever said anything about it. They would just send home more sight words for him to memorize, said Jill Adler, Nathan's mother. The assumption was, we weren't reading to him. We weren't doing what we were supposed to. It did not matter what we did. He could not learn to read. As alarming to Adler as her son's inability to learn to read was the school's ineffective response to his well-documented delay. It was very clear to me that his school had no idea what to do to help him, Adler said. They knew next to nothing about dyslexia. Some families at that point in the schooling process turned to independent schools to get more intensive help for their children. But special schools or private tutors can be costly. Now, however, a handful of public schools are emerging that are dedicated to serving students with dyslexia and other language-based reading delays. There appears to be no single model for such schools, but they do share some key similarities among their programs and the families they serve, many of whom arrive at these schools in a similar state of exhaustion after having tried and failed to make their local public schools work for their children. By the time people come here, they are completely desperate, said Maria Palicelli, the chief executive officer of Pittsburgh-based Provident Charter School, which opened in 2016 with about 50 students and currently serves 330 students with dyslexia and other language-based disorders in 2nd through 8th grades. The students come mainly from their local public schools after they failed to learn how to read. The section is called Schools Offer Small Student-to-Staff Ratios, Intensive Literacy Instruction. Each of these specialized public schools commit to small student-to-staff ratios and daily intensive literacy instruction using evidence-based approaches. Provident Charter's slightly longer-than-average school day accommodates a daily 45 to 60-minute reading intervention period led by teachers trained either in the Wilson or Orton-Gillingham approach to literacy instruction. Each small group session contains between 4 and 6 students per instructor. These intensive instruction periods happen in addition to daily 60 to 90-minute English language arts blocks. We build our schedule around reading intervention, not the other way around, Palicelli said. The Bridge Preparatory Charter School in the Staten Island borough of New York City brings the same level of intensity to its instruction for students with dyslexia and other language-based learning difficulties. It opened in September 2019 to students in grades 1 and 2 and now serves students in 1st through 5th grades from every zip code in that borough, according to Timothy Costanza, the school's co-founder and executive director. Unlike the other schools profiled in this article, Bridge Preparatory accepts a mix of students, some of whom have reading delays and others who don't. Costanza said that 63% of the school's current students have learning delays, primarily a literacy development delay or ADHD. The rest, he said, are general education learners. Our job is to prepare kids for the next space. We wanted to make sure we built a community that was neurodiverse, he said, adding that all students receive and benefit by the structured literacy approach the school provides. Every day, all students at Bridge Preparatory attend an hour-long period of Orton Gillingham instruction, followed by an independent reading period that gives them time to apply the literacy skills they are learning. The groups are fluid, explained Costanza, and are based on students' current reading readiness level. Literacy assessments take place 3 times a year, after which students might change groups according to their test results. The school day runs 1 hour and 10 minutes longer than most public schools to accommodate the 60-minute Orton-Gillingham period, Costanza explained. That's the only thing we are dogmatic about, he said. It's non-negotiable. We know that's the primary driver for our kids' growth. Daily intensive literacy intervention also takes priority at Allies Elementary, which stands for Academy for Literacy, Learning, and Innovation Excellence, a public school in Colorado Springs, Colorado, serving students in grades 2 to 5 that launched 6 years ago. During a daily 50-minute period, small groups of 3 or 4 students take part in Take Flight, an intervention program for students with dyslexia based on the Orton-Gillingham program and created by the Luke White Center for Dyslexia and Learning Disorders at Scottish Rite Hospital in Dallas. Certified academic language therapists teach the small groups. And we'll have to cut that article short for time.
The next article comes from the New York Times. The failed affirmative action campaign that shook Democrats. The Supreme Court will soon rule on race-conscious college admissions, a core Democratic issue. But an analysis of a California referendum points to a divide between the party and voters. By Michael Powell and Ilana Marcus. Posted June 11, 2023. The 2020 campaign to restore race-conscious affirmative action in California was close to gospel within the Democratic Party. It drew support from the governor, senators, state legislative leaders and a who's who of business, nonprofit and labor elites, Black, Latino, White and Asian. The Golden State Warriors, San Francisco Giants and 49ers and Oakland Athletics urged voters to support the referendum, Proposition 16, and remove systemic barriers. A commercial noted that Kamala Harris, then a U.S. Senator, had endorsed the campaign, and the ad also suggested that to oppose it was to side with white supremacy. Supporters raised many millions of dollars for the referendum and outspent opponents by 19-1. Vote for racial justice, urged the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. None of these efforts persuaded Jimmy Romero, a 63-year-old barber who grew up in the working-class Latino neighborhood of Wilmington in Los Angeles. Homelessness, illegal dumping, spiraling rents, he sat in his shop and listed so many problems. Affirmative action was not one of those. I was upset that they tried to push that, Mr. Romero recalled in a recent interview. It was not what matters. Mr. Romero was one of millions of California voters, including about half who are Hispanic and a majority who are Asian American, who voted against Proposition 16, which would have restored race-conscious admissions at public universities, and in government hiring and contracting. The breadth of that rejection shook supporters. California is a liberal bastion and one of the most diverse states in the country. That year, President Biden swamped Donald Trump by 29 percentage points in California, but Proposition 16 went down, with 57% of voters opposing it. That vote constitutes more than just a historical curiosity. The U.S. Supreme Court is soon expected to rule against, or limit, affirmative action in college admissions, which the court supported for decades. The court's decision could test the potency of affirmative action as an electoral issue, just as its decision last year to end a constitutional right to abortion led to a backlash that contributed to Democratic wins in congressional races and to abortion rights victories in such unlikely corners as Kansas. But Proposition 16 suggests the politics of affirmative action are different. The results exposed a gulf between the party establishment and its voters.
To make sense of its failure, the New York Times analyzed the 2020 vote, focusing on Los Angeles County, the nation's most populous county, and spoke to dozens of voters across demographic groups. Los Angeles voters, an ethnically diverse and liberal lot, passed the proposition by a mere whisker, 51% to 49%. and the Times analysis of electoral precincts found across all races, support for the referendum fell well short of support for Joe Biden on the same ballot. This was true across majority Black, Asian, Hispanic, and white precincts. In 1996, California voters banned affirmative action, during a more conservative time, with a Republican governor. By 2020, with liberal Californians infuriated about Donald Trump and the murder of George Floyd, Democratic leaders hoped Los Angeles voters would run up big margins and overcome conservative opposition elsewhere in the state. Democrats have yearned for a demographic deliverance, arguing a multiracial coalition would inevitably elevate their progressive policies. Proposition 16 points to a more uncertain reality. Carlos E. Cortez has lived the history of diversity in California. An emeritus professor and historian of race and ethnicity, he became the second Mexican-descended scholar to join the faculty of the University of California, Riverside. He supported the measure, even as he understood its limited appeal.
"It's not going to cause great eruptions of protest," Dr. Cortez said. Speaking of the possible end of affirmative action, which, he noted, is a reliable loser at the ballot box. If they keep making it a cause, they will just alienate Hispanic and Asian voters. The next section is titled, Expectations Upended. California's college officials frame support for Proposition 16 as a matter of social justice. They said it would lead to more diverse campuses and allow students to understand sad historical legacies. There is amazing momentum for righting the wrongs caused by centuries of systemic racism in our country, John A. Perez, then the chairman of the California Board of Regents, said during the 2020 campaign. There was the view, too, that California's 1996 ban deprived Black and Hispanic business owners, who have less generational wealth than white counterparts, of hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts. And we'll have to cut this article short for time.
The next article comes from the New York Daily News, and it's titled, Transgender Students in New York Can Use the Names, Pronouns They Choose Without Parental Consent, by Kayla Bamberger, posted June 12, 2023. Schools across New York should support transgender students using the names and pronouns they choose without needing parental knowledge or consent, state education officials said Monday. The guidance was included in a 42-page update to regulations first released nearly 8 years ago. Some of the guidelines from the New York State Education Department are rooted in anti-discrimination bills signed into law in recent years. The stakes are high for transgender and gender-expansive students who do not identify as male or female, and may run into unique obstacles while approaching schoolwork and relationships with classmates. A survey by the youth nonprofit The Trevor Project found 16% of transgender respondents based in New York have attempted suicide, compared to 12% of LGBTQ+ young people. "I was not ready yet to tell my parents that I didn't want to use the name that they had spent so much time and thought choosing for me," a senior at a suburban high school who was transgender told the Board of Regents during a meeting Monday. "So I approached my teachers individually and asked them to use a different name for me when I was at school. Even though I had only informally changed my name, I was able to use it in almost every area of my life at school," she added. "So then a couple months later, when I told my parents, I felt very comfortable doing so because I was sure that I had found an authentic name." The guidelines also suggest that schools include representations of transgender and non-binary people in school curriculum, as well as reiterate state education law prohibiting discrimination based on gender identity and expression in gym classes and sports teams. Recommendations include phasing out gym classes separated by gender unless there is a reason to do so, such as sports that have different rules by gender. Physical education teachers can use such sports as an opportunity to examine gender bias in sports, the pros and cons of gender segregation, and current events, read the document. Recommendations from the New York State Education Department also promote student privacy and confidentiality, from how to handle education records to what are the latest resources to teachers and children. The update provides tips and suggestions to administrators and educators, Michael Montoya from the Student Support Services Office told the Regents, for ways to work closely with the student on a plan, one that the student feels comfortable with, to inform and educate their peers and school staff on what the student would like to share about their transition and with whom they would like to share it. I want to emphasize that every student is treated as an individual, and their needs are paramount. Education officials encouraged school districts to create a gender support plan with students who need them to systematically address their school experience and bring all school personnel on the same page. The guidelines also outline procedures for school records that adhere to federal and state law. Schools must update education records if a student provides documentation for a legal name change or risk violating state human rights law. Education officials recommend that all previous records that do not reflect the change be kept in a separate confidential folder or archived in student information systems. If a student requests a name or pronoun change to their records, schools are directed to, quote, honor that request, but advised to consult legal counsel about whether minors need parental consent if the record is permanent. A diploma, for example, is considered a ceremonial certificate, so education officials recommend students have their request respected. Alumni can also request a reissued diploma with their chosen name, the guidance read. We make sure that documents that students take with them when they graduate reflect their affirmed identities, said Dr. Michael Paff, a school psychologist in the Hudson Valley. Without unintentionally outing them as transgender and potentially exposing them to discrimination. The recommendations stem from an advisory group that shaped the original guidance and reconvened for more than a year. Bottom line, we think it's very clear that the laws require schools to take steps to support the student, Kathleen DeCataldo, Assistant Commissioner of Student Support Services at the Education Department, told the Daily News. We wanted to make sure schools were aware of those laws and their responsibilities and obligations.
The next article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, When Are Student Loans Resuming? Payment Pause to Be Lifted This Fall, by Medora Lee, posted June 12, 2023. About 45 million Americans may have to pare back their final summer Labor Day weekend trip this year because that's the weekend interest starts accruing again on federal student loans, and they'll have to be financially ready to start repaying. Without a Supreme Court ruling before June 30th, interest begins adding up again on September 1st, the Friday before Labor Day. The first payments on student loans in more than 3 years will be due in October, according to an Education Department spokesperson. That's because, in exchange for a raised debt ceiling about 10 days ago, the Biden administration agreed, among other things, that it wouldn't postpone the end of the quote final pause as it did last year. Last August, the administration said the fourth and final extension would expire on December 31, 2022, but by November, it extended the deadline to either 60 days after the Supreme Court issues a decision on the relief program or 60 days after June 30, whichever came first. The next section is titled, Expect to Hear from Loan Servicers Ahead of Bills Coming Due. To assist the roughly 45 million Americans who have federal student debt, the Education Department spokesperson said it will, quote, be in direct touch with borrowers and ramping up our communications with servicers well before repayment resumes to ensure borrowers and their families are receiving accurate and timely information about the return to repayment. However, loan servicers have warned that budget cuts at the Department of Education forced the agency months ago to modify its contracts with servicers. Changes included cutting the pay servicers earn helping each borrower and the minimum number of hours customer service centers must open each week. Those cuts translate into fewer servicers working fewer hours to help people coming off a fifth consecutive payment pause. Servicers are the first people borrowers turn to when they need help with their student loans. Servicers help borrowers enroll in affordable repayment programs and manage the other logistics of paying student loan bills. What can you do now to avoid long waits? Be proactive. Contact your loan servicer now before repayments resume to find out what your interest rate is, confirm personal information, loan amounts, and payment plans. If your income has changed and you're not sure you can make your payments, your loan servicer can walk you through your options. The Biden administration revamped income-driven repayment, or IDR plans, making them more affordable to many more people. Can the Supreme Court still stop repayments? No, not for everyone. Even if the Supreme Court rules student debt relief can proceed, which most see as unlikely, about 25 million Americans would still have some balance to pay. That's because of the roughly 45 million people who hold student debt. President Joe Biden said about 20 million would have their debt completely erased if his plan is upheld by the Supreme Court, leaving 25 million who would still have to make some payments. The White House Student Loan Relief Plan forgives up to $20,000 in student loans for Americans with individual incomes of less than $125,000. The average borrower has around $38,000 in loans and will still need to make payments even if the Biden forgiveness plan goes into effect, according to a recent survey from Highway Benefits, an employee benefits platform company.
The next article comes from NBC News and it's titled, Three Arrested at Protests Outside an LA School Board Meeting About Pride Month. The Glendale Unified School District Board was hearing comments from the public about recognizing Pride Month when police declared the protests outside unlawful assembly. By Emmy Toyani Tran. Posted June 7, 2023. Three arrests were made Tuesday as protesters violently clashed outside a Los Angeles County School District building, where board members had convened to vote on whether or not to recognize June as Pride Month, according to the Glendale Police Department. Hundreds of people gathered outside the Glendale Unified School District headquarters both in opposition and in support of the school district's LGBTQ policies. Anti-LGBTQ protesters waved American flags and chanted, "Leave our kids alone," and the names of the five school board members. Counter-protesters waved pride flags and held up signs rebuking anti-LGBTQ sentiments, according to the Los Angeles Times. The board was about an hour into hearing comments from the public when police declared the protests unlawful assembly, due to instances of physical violence, including unauthorized pepper spray use, police said. Attendees of the school board meeting were ordered to shelter in place, and police cordoned the building entrance with yellow tape. Glendale police issued a statement saying that, while most of the protest was peaceful, a small group of individuals engaged in behavior deemed unsafe. Three people were arrested and removed from the protest. Just past 6 p.m., after additional attempts to de-escalate the situation were unsuccessful, the Glendale Police Department issued a dispersal order for the entire protest. After police dispersed the protests, the school board unanimously voted to recognize June as Pride Month. Nahiri Nahabedian, president of the school board, said at the meeting that this was the fourth year that GUSD called for recognition of Pride Month, according to the Los Angeles Times. Despite the uproar happening outside of the meeting, the school board was simply voting on whether or not Glendale Unified should recognize June as LGBTQ+ Pride Month. What should have been an amicable meeting, even if there was disagreement among some community members, turned into a shelter-in-place order that frightened participants, the statement reads. The center also pushed back against the notion, popularized by the GOP, that LGBTQ-inclusive curricula in schools is harmful for children. It cited the Trevor Project, which found that LGBTQ inclusion can reduce the risk of emotional distress and even suicide in youth. Topics of gender and sexuality in education have become a flashpoint for conservatives, who argue that these topics should not be taught or mentioned in schools. This rhetoric is fueled by an increasing number of laws enacted across the U.S., aimed at restricting access to gender-affirming healthcare for trans youth and limiting discussion about sexual orientation and gender identity in public grade schools. Last week, an unidentified individual broke into Sadakoy Elementary School in North Hollywood, California, and burned a rainbow flag before a scheduled pride-themed assembly. The incident is currently being investigated as a hate crime by Los Angeles police.
We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.